ethnographers, the isolation of menstruating women in a special hut, arose as a means of protecting menstruating women and other members of the band from predators, which might be drawn by the smell of menstrual blood. Though it would take a particularly sturdy hut to deter a determined predator. The vagina, in myth sometimes a vagina dentata, represents a mouth as well as a wound, and the mouth of the predator animal is often its most powerful weapon. Long before the male phallus gained its symbolic status as a weapon, the blood-smeared mouth may have been the organ most associated with violence and potency. Traditional and folk imagery sometimes connects blood to the human female's literal mouth. Kali is represented with blood flowing from her mouth, sometimes in highly stylized form, as a red triangle with its apex just under her lower lip. Maori and some Amerindian women tattooed themselves with parallel lines proceeding down along the chin from the mouth, suggesting the flow of blood, and sometimes called dribble lines. Moderns wear lipstick. The mythologies of some traditional cultures hint at a mysterious affinity between menstruating women and the predatory beasts. In the origin myth of the people of Northeast Arnhem Land in Australia, two sisters are swallowed by a monstrous snake, which has been aroused by their vaginal blood. One of the sisters gives birth, and her blood flows into the sacred pool inhabited by the rainbow serpent, who emerges in anger. "Go away! Go away!" the sisters cried, as they saw the immense snake in the sky. Seized with fear, they sang Menstrual Blood, the most potent and taboo of the songs known to them, and danced to make the snake go away. But dancing only brought on the second sister's menstrual flow, attracting the serpent still more. The sisters flee into the menstrual hut they have built, but the serpent follows and swallows them alive. From within the serpent, the sisters proceed to assign names to all the objects on earth, using as their own the thunder-like voice of the snake itself, which is male in some versions of the myth, female in others. Peculiar as this story may sound, it is hardly unique. According to Levi Strauss, versions of this myth appear to belong to all peoples, irrespective of time and race. Among tribal people of southern Venezuela, the rainbow serpent is the water-dwelling anaconda, or mawari, which is driven crazy with desire by the smell of menstrual blood. The anaconda rise up from the river in droves, kill all the men, capture the women, and take them down into the snake's watery home. In other mythologies, the devouring beast associated with menstruation is a wild dog, a jaguar, or a female leopard. It is tempting to discern, in myths connecting the goddess to the hunt and the menstruating woman to the hunting animal, a time when real women played a central role in the realms of both economies and religion. In the economy, as participants in the hunt. In religion, as beings whose bodies had the seemingly divine gift of bleeding without dying, and doing so regularly, in tune with the most salient cycle of the night skies. Writer Judy Gron notes the linguistic links between menstruation and words for ritual in the Indo-European languages, and suggests that menstruation may have been the forerunner and basis for all ritual. Similarly, anthropologist Chris Knight makes an elaborate and, on the face of it, quite plausible argument for menstrual synchrony as a basis of female solidarity and power in Paleolithic times. But on the intriguing political issue of Paleolithic gender relations, the archaeological record is frustratingly noncommittal. All we know for sure is that by the beginning of the historical era, the capacity for violence and bloodletting would be almost universally conceived as a male trait. Hunting would be an exclusively male activity, though still an occasional sport for aristocratic women. The fierce goddesses of an older time would be tamed enough to take their place within pantheons dominated by male gods. Menstruation would cease to be a public event. In the new male-centered scheme of things, it is the boys who enter adulthood through dramatic blood rites of initiation, while girls at menarche are shut up in menstrual huts, stitched into hammocks, or simply instructed to hide all evidence of their flow, as if it were a kind of excrement. The defeat of the goddess. In the Sumerian epic of Gilgamesh, which dates from around 2000 BC, the killing of the predator beast is linked directly to the hero's defiance of the goddess. After Gilgamesh and his companion Enkidu slay the forest monster Humbaba, the goddess Inanna, Ishtar, attempts to seduce Gilgamesh. "Come to me, Gilgamesh, and be my bridegroom. Grant me seed of your body." He rejects her rudely, pointing out that her past lovers, which included a lion and a stallion, have all met terrible ends. Enraged, Inanna sets the bull of heaven loose on the two heroes. They make short work of the bull, but the goddess herself is still powerful enough to strike Enkidu with a fatal illness. "My friend," he tells Gilgamesh, "the great goddess cursed me, and I must die in shame." Could there have been some real event or trend that brought an end to the predator goddess's reign and ushered in the era of the male warrior hero? If so, it must have occurred long before the Neolithic Revolution brought forth settled agricultural communities. Because whatever happened, happened almost worldwide, and it happened also among peoples who continued to make their living exclusively as hunter-gatherers, such as, for example, the indigenous Australians, who even now recall in myth the male theft of women's magic. One possible candidate for this crucial event is a change in hunting strategies, which seems to have occurred sometime near the end of the Paleolithic or the beginning of the Mesolithic period which followed it. This was a time when the supply of large game animals was dwindling in many parts of the world, leaving people scrambling to exploit less efficient food sources, such as birds, fish, and mollusks. Hunting, too, had to change. As large migratory animals became scarce, or even extinct, the strategy of the drive, or the surround, in which a band of humans drove a herd of animals over a cliff or into a cul-de-sac, obviously became less productive. Instead, human hunters turned to tracking individual animals and killing them one by one. With continuing declines in big game populations in most parts of the globe, hunting everywhere became a matter of quiet and patient stalking, better suited to small groups of men than to noisy assemblages that included women and children. This change in hunting strategy was probably accompanied by the beginnings of what military historian Arthur Farrell has called the First Arms Revolution. "Between 12,000 and 8,000 years ago," he writes, "humans enriched their armamentarium of spears and clubs with new inventions like the bow and arrow, the dagger, and the sling. The new, more powerful projectile weapons helped make hunting by stalking possible. For one thing, it was easier now for small groups of humans to wander far from their home base without fear of becoming prey themselves. The bow and arrow seems particularly well suited to a stalking strategy, while the spear and club may have been most useful in drive styles of hunting, when a line of people moved in on the cornered animals for the kill." Anthropologist Lila Leibowitz argued that this change in hunting strategy may have been responsible for a new sexual division of labor, and with it, a general demotion of the female sex. Instead of the communal hunt undertaken by the whole band, there was now the male hunter's sub-band, with women relegated to the less glamorous job of processing the meat, as well as the skin, bones, and other useful animal products brought back by men. If so, this might help explain the general decline in depictions of human females in the art of the upper, or more recent, Paleolithic. On the eve of the Neolithic, the human male was probably a good, goddess-fearing soul. But he held the spear, the sling, and the bow, all firmly in his hand. In surviving hunting-gathering cultures, not only are women expected to remain behind while men hunt, they are often barred from contact with men's weapons or other magic items. Possibly, with the historic change to a male-only hunting strategy, violence in general began to be seen as the exclusive prerogative of males. Even women's involuntary bloodshed must, in most traditional societies, be thoroughly kept from sight. In the patriarchal era, as anthropologist Nancy Jay has written, the blood shed by men in sacrifice or war is powerful and redeeming, while the blood shed by women becomes a dangerous pollutant. In Greek mythology, a special horror attaches to the image of the violent woman, or worse, the violent, blood-soaked group of women. In Euripides' play, The Bacchae, which was based on a far older myth, the god Dionysus has led the women of Thebes, including the king's mother and sisters, off to join his maenads, or Bacchae, who roam in the wild, dancing, singing, and tearing living animals apart. A herdsman describes these wild women in terms that might have suited the archaic goddess in her role as mistress of the animals. Their hair flows loose, their garments are made of fawn skin, and they girdled the dappled fur with snakes which licked their cheeks. And some would have in their arms a young gazelle, or wild wolf cubs, and give them their own white milk. Angered by some herdsmen, though, the maenads begin to act, quite literally, like beasts. Here the playwright could be describing the anarchy of the old-style communal hunt, where women, as well as men, rush in among the cornered animals for the kill. Tearing our cows limb from limb, and you could see perhaps some ribs or a left hoof being tossed high and low, and pieces of bloody flesh hung dripping on the pine branches. When King Pentheus goes after the maenads, his own mother, Agawa, foaming at the mouth, her eyes rolling wildly, leads the attack on him. She set her foot against his ribs, and she tore his arm off by the shoulder. There was a single, continuous yell, Pentheus shrieking, as long as life was left in him, the women howling in triumph. One of them was carrying an arm. Another had a foot, with the shoes still on it. The ribs were stripped, clawed clean. Every hand was thick red with blood, and they were tossing and catching to and fro like a ball, the flesh of Pentheus. Still under the spell of the god, and believing that she has killed a lion, Agawe carries what is left of her son back to her father, stating proudly, I have left weaving at the loom for greater things, for hunting wild beasts with my bare hands. The moral, of course, is stick to your weaving. For women, wilderness is an incitement to wildness. Darkness is treacherous and impure. And the violence of the hunt quickly degenerates into a manic savagery that swallows up humans and animals alike. In Aeschylus's play, The Furies, another murderous band of females, blood dirty from their predations, must be persuaded to accept a new and gentler role as household guardians. The violent, bestial female resurfaces briefly centuries later in Virgil's Aeneid, where, as the Fury Alecto, she attempts to goad Turnus into waging war against Aeneas. At first he brushes her off. Let men run war and peace. But even as he spoke, a sudden trembling seized him. His eyes stared. The fury hisses with so many serpents, so monstrous is the face she shows. She turned her flaming eyes and thrust him, faltering, back. She lifted up two vipers from her hair. Her lash was loud. With maddened lips, she added this, Then look at me. I come here from the home of the dread sisters, and in my hand, I carry death and wars. But such monstrous females, had no place in the patriarchal order, which attempted to efface every vestige of the archaic association between the human female and the predator beast. Henceforth, for the most part, males alone would be privileged to reenact the transformation from prey to predator. Deprived in most cases of a blood rite of initiation, females would have no ritual escape from the child status as prey. This aspect of the female condition is brought out forcefully in the kind of marriage rites described by early anthropologists as marriage by capture, in which the groom and his friends abduct the bride from her home, while the bride and her family resist, or pretend to resist, the abduction. Such practices are so widespread that there appear to be no geographical or religious boundaries to them. Anthropologist Maurice Bloch tells us, for example, that in ancient Rome, the marriage ritual reenacted and celebrated the story of the rape of the Sabine women. While in Shinto Japan, marriage is often seen as part of a triumphal consumption of the female by the male. If females have any ritual transformation to undergo, it is in the opposite direction, from predator to prey. Ancient Greek art features the young unmarried woman as a wild animal, both powerful and virginal, like Artemis, the predator goddess herself. For example, a 5th century BC terracotta relief from Melos shows the mortal Peleus grabbing the goddess Thetis, who is at least a foot taller than her in this depiction, around the waist, while a lion, representing one form she assumed in an effort to thwart her suitor, menaces him from her other side. According to art historian Angela M. H. Schuster, the Parthenos, or unmarried woman, had to be tamed like a wild animal. And this was to be accomplished through marriage and motherhood. The taming process was echoed in courtship rituals, which appear in many artistic representations as pursuit scenes, with the suitor as hunter, the Parthenos as prey. Appropriately, according to British classicist Helen King, the wedding was designed in part to evoke the preparation of an animal for sacrifice. For example, cutting the bride's hair, washing, giving a sign of consent, and wearing a garland. The married woman, or gune, King tells us, was at the opposite pole to the Parthenos. She should bleed in menstruation, defloration, and childbirth as part of her role in reproducing society. But she should not shed blood. Only a man may shed blood in war and sacrifice. By assigning the triumphant predator status to males alone, humans have helped themselves to forget that nightmarish prehistory in which they were all, male and female, prey to larger, stronger animals. Insofar as males have been the human norm and females the deviation, weakness and vulnerability could be seen as something aberrant and incidental to the story of humankind. Gender, in other words, is an idea that conveniently obliterates our common past as prey and states that the predator status is innate and natural, at least to men. Part 2. War. 7. A rough male sport. It makes no difference what men think of war. War endures. As well ask men what they think of stone. War was always here. Before man was, war waited for him. The ultimate trade, awaiting the ultimate practitioner. Cormac McCarthy. The first evidence of what looks to modern eyes like war comes from the Mesolithic, roughly 12,000 years ago. A rock drawing from the Spanish Levant shows bands of stick figures wielding bows and arrows against one another. Masked skeletons of the same vintage have been unearthed in southern Egypt and in East Asia, with piercings by spear and arrow points suggestive of deliberate massacres. What these people fought over, no one knows. Agriculture, with its movable treasures of grain and animal herds, was still presumably only a gleam in some hungry woman's eye. Territorial hunting rights are a possibility, or women, or injured pride, or even the need, as perceived by the pious, to capture victims for human sacrifice. On two points, there is little controversy, though, if only because they seem so obvious. One is that war has roots in, and in some sense grows out of, prior conflicts with animals. The earliest weapons of war were almost certainly developed for use against animal life, as were the tactics of the wedge and frontal attack. Well into the modern era, in fact, light regiments, which advanced in a line, much as Paleolithic hunters may have done in their drives against animals, were called hunters, jägers, chasseurs, and were dressed in green. The second point may be uncontroversial in part because it is seldom, if ever, made. And that is that the rise of war corresponds roughly with a global decline in the number of large animals, both game and predators, for humans to fight against. Many scholars have attempted to explain war as a function of rising human population density and the attendant competition for resources. But the key factor may be animal populations, and these were declining in the Mesolithic on what was, in many settings, a catastrophic scale. Fast forward to the last few millennia of prehistory, with some camera capable of taking in whole plains and forests and meadows, and the unmistakable trend will be toward a planet seriously depleted of all large-scale hooved and furry life. 10 or 12,000 years ago, at the end of the Ice Age, the Northern Hemisphere was still thickly populated by large land animals, bison, wild cattle, giant ground sloths, mammoths, peccaries, wild goats and camels, rhinoceroses, and so forth. Within a few thousand years, whole species, in fact whole classes of megafauna, were gone forever, extinct. Paleontologists still debate the exact mix of factors that led to these mass extinctions. Climactic changes, the retreat of the glaciers, the spread of forests on formerly grassy plains. But one factor which few any longer deny was the advent of the human hunter. In many parts of the world, the extinction of megafauna coincides neatly with the arrival of human hunting-gathering bands. The German paleontologist W. Schuller writes that, in Africa, the beginning of the impoverishment of megafauna approximately coincides with the evolutions of the early hominids. In the rest of the world, with the first appearance of Homo. The Eurasian continent is a slightly messier case. There, the extinctions took place over a long period of time and may have been driven in part by the reforestation which followed glacial retreat and destroyed open grazing lands. But in Australia, New Guinea, and Oceania, the extinctions began at the same time migrating humans arrived. In North America, the arrival of big game hunters from Asia, the Clovis people, named for an archaeological site near Clovis, New Mexico, about 11,500 years ago, was followed by the disappearance of 35 entire classes of mammals. As in other venues, the small animals were spared. But most of the large herbivores that humans would have favored as game were decimated within perhaps 1,000 years or less, along with the carnivores that fed on them. Among their bones, archaeologists have found the distinctive fluted spear points of the Clovis hunters. To the extent that humans were responsible for the animal holocaust of the late Ice Age, they may not have been motivated entirely by hunger. In North America, the human population on the eve of the extinctions was probably well under 1 million, while the large mammals numbered from 50 to 100 million. The biomass slaughtered, even assuming that half of a carcass by weight is waste, appears to have been well beyond the capacity of human appetite. One speculation is that humans caused much of this damage unwittingly, by spreading a microbial disease that specialized in killing large mammals other than humans. But another possibility is that humans simply killed far more than they needed to, as suggested by Paleolithic mass kill sites, in which only the top layer of animal carcasses appears to have been utilized as food. This is what the paleontologists call overkill, and it must have been, to those humans who engaged in it, a dramatic proof of human predatory prowess. In human cultures, hunting is seldom a matter of mere food acquisition anyway. It is usually a highly ritualized activity, tied into local systems of prestige and religious authority. Prehistoric hunters, like contemporary hunter-gatherers, probably observed prescribed rites and taboos before and after the hunt, and during the distribution of meat and the disposal of bones. In many cases, the hunt itself may have been as much a ritual as a food-gathering errand. Humans have hunted, in part, for the same reasons they have sacrificed living creatures or terrified their children with nightmarish rites of initiation, as a way of reenacting the primal transformation from prey to predator. In defense of humankind, we should note that no other animal, at least none that I have been able to discover, has experienced the kind of evolutionary role reversal achieved by our species within just a few hundred thousand years. 1 million years ago, lions, or something very like them, were lions, and antelopes were antelopes, and one the prey of the other, pretty much as they are now. Only the line of Homo made a decisive advance up the food chain, learning to band together in highly organized ways to augment their strength with fire and sharpened stones, and to enrich their strategies with verbal memories of past exploits. Our victory over the other animals was a brilliant achievement, but clearly, it took its toll. The kindest thing one can conclude about the long record of human carnage is that it may have been only through the compulsive repetition of acts and spectacles of violence, the hunt, the sacrifice, the initiatory ordeal, and eventually the war, that our ancestors were able to reassure themselves that they were, in fact, no longer prey. At some point, inevitably, there were no longer enough wild animals to satisfy either the hunger or the anxiety of the human race. Even at very low human population densities, the productivity of hunting is eventually limited by the supply of animals to hunt. Most human cultures reached this point about 10,000 years ago, immediately following the extinctions of the late Ice Age. There was nothing to do then but turn to agriculture and to war. The Neolithic Revolution, which is usually depicted as an epical advance and triumph of human ingenuity, may be more accurately described as a desperate adaptation to ever-shrinking stocks of game. Hunting continued to be a favorite sport and a supplementary food source, but for the most part, humans switched from preying on wild animals to preying, usually with far greater restraint, on ones that they owned. The only economically significant version of hunting which survived into the Neolithic was raiding, in which bands of men, and eventually armies, attempted to steal one another's herds. In his study of Siberian reindeer economies, anthropologist Tim Ingold writes, "As the live animal resource passes into the domain of human property relations, competitive strength is redirected from the interaction between men and animals to the interaction between men in respect of animals. The pastoralist becomes a predator on his own kind." Under these new conditions, the predator beast, which had seemed to rule the world at one time and to personify, as deity, the violence of nature, becomes little more than a pest. The human obligation to the animals they owned and ate was to protect them from wild predators, like wolves and lions, whose status in the human scheme of things declined accordingly. Wolves running wild, hunting other wild things, held a mystic power for human hunting peoples. But the wolf that robs the chicken coop or drags off the newborn lambs comes to be seen by humans as a hateful competitor, if not a parasite, and subject to exterminatory measures. At an earlier stage of human evolution, the roles had been reversed. Humans were the scavengers, animal predators the providers of meat. Nature as a whole loses some of its mystic power, Ingold speculates, when the power of disposal over a wild animal resource passes from the spirits to men. Historians of a materialist bent have tended to locate the beginnings of war, or what they dignify as real war, that is, as opposed to mere raiding, near the time of the rise of agriculture, when human societies began to possess things like land and stores of grain that were worth risking death to capture. Some of the earliest Neolithic settlements unearthed, like that at Jericho, were surrounded with thick walls clearly meant to discourage human intruders. According to the scenario laid out by Robert L. O'Connell, real systematic war arises as nomadic herding peoples discover that raiding settled agricultural communities can be a more efficient way to make a living than patiently nurturing one's own food supplies. The settled communities, in turn, develop armed defenses, and these are, soon enough, employed offensively against neighboring settlements. But there are at least two problems with this account. One is that it discounts the evidence for war in the Mesolithic period, that is, before the emergence of agricultural civilizations. In War Before Civilization, anthropologist Lawrence Keeley makes a convincing argument that the scholarly tendency to see primitive war as somehow less real than the civilized kind is little more than a condescending bias. In historical times, primitives have fought as seriously and effectively as have the highly organized armies of modern nation-states. The Sioux and Cheyenne victory over Custer at Little Bighorn offering one familiar example. Furthermore, the archaeological record strongly suggests that Mesolithic wars between hunter-gatherers were frequent and deadly. More than half the 59 men, women, and children buried about 12,000 years ago at Jebel Sahaba in southern Egypt appear to have died violently, most from stone projectile points, and many show fractures indicative of injuries inflicted in earlier encounters. The other problem with the standard account is its assumption that people will not fight, or perhaps I should say, really fight, unless there are vital material resources, such as the potential loot generated by agricultural communities, at stake. This view slights the widespread conflicts over goods, which serve little function except as badges of prestige and warrior prowess, scalps and skulls, severed heads, hands, penises, and other portable body parts, captives for rituals of human sacrifice. Just as prehistoric humans probably killed animals for reasons other than hunger, they no doubt killed one another for purposes other than gain, such as the accumulation of a particularly imposing collection of severed heads. As Keeley points out, there is evidence for prehistoric headhunting in numerous sites, suggesting that early wars may have been motivated in some cases by factors other than hunger. So we may be in better conformity with the facts to say that war arises in the Mesolithic epoch, a time of diminishing game and predator populations, and that it arises, at least in part, as a new source of prestige for men who might otherwise have been employed as hunters and as defenders against wild animals. Which is to say that war served not only to enrich the victorious community as a whole, but to enhance the status of a specific group within it, the men who fought or led the fighting. Recall that the Mesolithic, the epoch when war, or at least warlike raiding, apparently begins, was the time when, generally speaking, communal hunting had given way to the strategy of stalking individual animals, most likely undertaken by small groups of male hunters. In the scenario first suggested, as far as I can tell, by historian Lewis Mumford, there is a direct continuity of personnel between the male hunting subband and the first warrior bands. The earliest warriors we know through recorded literature, the Sumerian hero Gilgamesh and his companion Enkidu, were not only warriors, but hunters and battlers of killer beasts. So, as mentioned earlier, were the Greek chieftains who fought at Troy. In their homelands, in times of peace, they had battled lions and wild boars. According to the French classicist Pierre Vidal-Naquet, the culture heroes of the Greek legends are all hunters and destroyers of wild beasts. With the decline of wild predator and game populations, there would have been little to occupy the males who had specialized in hunting and anti-predator defense, and no well-trodden route to the status of hero. What saved the hunter-defender male from obsolescence or a life of agricultural toil was the fact that he possessed weapons and the skills to use them. Mumford suggests that the hunter-defender preserved his status by turning to a kind of protection racket. Pay him with food and social standing, or be subject to his predations. Eventually, the presence of underemployed hunter-defenders in other human settlements guaranteed a new and foreign menace to defend against. The hunter-defenders of one band or settlement could justify their upkeep by pointing to the threat posed by their counterparts in other groups. And the danger could always be made more vivid by staging a raid from time to time. As Gwyn Dyer observes in his Survey of War, pre-civilized warfare was predominantly a rough male sport for underemployed hunters. In small-scale societies, not only unique heroes like Enkidu, but the majority of adult men would have found themselves in need of some substitute for the hunter-defender role. As encounters with wild animals, both game and predators, became less central to human survival, so, potentially, did adult males become less central to the survival of women and children. Women could grow crops, and certainly do so almost single-handedly in horticultural societies today. Women and children could care for domesticated animals, although armed men would still be more effective at defending the herds against wild predators. There was no indispensable and uniquely male occupation left. In their engaging study of warfare among Southwestern American Indians, anthropologists Clifton B. Kroeber and Bernard L. Fontana propose that war may indeed have arisen to fill the void. One by one, they eliminate the various materialist theories involving land and access to water, which have been offered to explain these people's perpetual wars, and propose instead that war persists because it is a prestigious thing for men to do, that it is an exciting and even religious undertaking. In their account, the rise of agriculture is important to the history of war, only insofar as it signals the decline of hunting and the decreasing economic contribution of the male sex. They quote from a study of the Navajo. A relative decrease of available game animals threatens the status of men. Worldwide, this has produced secret men's associations, which artificially try to maintain the old glory and comradeship which formerly existed during hunting expeditions. And what better way to maintain the old glory, Kroeber and Fontana suggest, than to recast the men's association as an army and replace the hunting expedition with war? I should remind the reader that a theory of the origin of war is not the same as a theory of war. To say that war may have begun as a substitute activity and source of prestige for male hunters is not to say that all wars ever since serve the same function. Something does not necessarily persist for the same reasons it begins. But the notion that war initially served the interests of a particular human subgroup, adult males, or the specialized hunter-defenders among them, is at least consistent with the fact that war has been, in historical times, almost universally, the business of men, and men alone. Masculinity and war. War is, in fact, one of the most rigidly gendered activities known to humankind. So nearly exclusive is the connection between war and manhood that some scholars of war, typically male, have felt little need to mention the existence of a sex alternative to their own. A 1990 anthology on the anthropology of war, written entirely by males, contains no index entries on gender or masculinity, and mentions women fewer than a dozen times, as wives, captives of war, and participants in cannibal feasts. Other writers, typically female, are so struck by the link between masculinity and war that they find in masculinity, or even mere biological maleness, a satisfyingly complete explanation of war. In this view, war becomes an inevitable outgrowth of male aggressiveness, with the weaponry, the thrust of spears and missiles, the piercing and explosions, all mimicking the phallic side of sex. The gendering of war goes far deeper than that of, say, the weaving Hector recommends to Andromache. Go therefore back to our house and take up your own work, the loom and the distaff, and see to it that your handmaidens ply their work also. But the men must see to the fighting. Probably invented by women, weaving has been, in certain periods and places, inextricably tied to notions of womanhood. Hence, for example, the notion of women's realm as the distaff side of human affairs. But in other situations, or with new technologies, weaving has been just as securely a manly thing to do. Similarly, many other roles and occupations, that of religious leader, healer, farmer, fisher, pottery maker, have been shared at times or fought over by men and women. In the case of war, history offers no such alternations between the sexes. Certainly there are instances of female warriorship, but except for the female regiment maintained by Dahomeyan kings in West Africa, these are usually mythological, like the Amazons, or aristocratic, like the ancient British warrior queen, Boadicea. More commonly, women who have wanted to become warriors have had to first become men. Among the many examples historian Julie Wheelwright offers of women who have dressed as men in order to fight is Deborah Sampson, who transformed herself into Robert Shurtleff and enlisted in the American Revolutionary Army. There she served with distinction until a shoulder wound gave her sex away. How she managed urination and menstruation up until that time remains a mystery. We know only that she preserved her chastity inviolate by the most artful concealment of her sex. Not only have women had to dress as men to become warriors in many cultures, men who failed as warriors have been reviled as women. Anthropologist of war, Maurice Davy, relates that when the Iroquois denationalized the Delawares and prohibited them from going to war, the latter were, according to the Indian notion, made women, and were henceforth to confine themselves to pursuits appropriate to women. Among the Pomo of California, when a man became too infirm to be a warrior, he was made a menial and required to assist the squaws. This was true in Cuba and Greenland, with the additional degradation of wearing female dress. Or consider the Fang people of the Congo, where a man unarmed was not considered a true man and was told to go and rear children. When a group of Fang men shot someone down in an ambush, they came home shouting, "We are real men. We are real men. We have been to town and shot a man. We are men, real men." Thus, War making is not simply another occupation that men have monopolized. It is an activity that has often served to define manhood itself, which is exactly what we would expect if war in fact originated as substitute occupation for underemployed male hunter-defenders. In historical times, one of the acknowledged purposes of war has often been to make men men. That is, to give the adult male something uniquely manly to do. The archaic Greeks waged what the French historian Yvon Garland called ritual wars for the purpose of initiating young men into manhood, meaning also warriordom. Tacitus reported a similar function for war among the ancient Germans. Many noble youths, if the land of their birth is stagnating in a protracted peace, deliberately seek out other tribes, where some war is afoot. The Germans have no taste for peace. Renown is easier won among perils, and you cannot maintain a large body of companions, young warriors serving a chief, except by violence and war. Among the traditional cultures encountered by 19th and early 20th century anthropologists, the passage from boyhood to manhood often required successful participation in war, meaning often the killing of an enemy. Davy tells us that a Maasai is not supposed to marry until he has blooded his spear. The Karamojo youth must distinguish himself in war before he may marry. Among the natives of Papuan Gulf, a man must be initiated as a warrior before he is free to enter the marital state. The Naga warrior has to bring home a scalp or skull before he is qualified to marry. Similarly, among the Kaoka speakers of Guadalcanal, a young man had to take part in a campaign and shed blood before he was eligible for marriage or the office of priesthood. Legendary stories relate that, after a long period of peace, villagers would deliberately send insults to one another to provoke a fight. We find the same theme among American Indians. A Creek might be famous for oratory, stoicism under trial, or wisdom in council. But if he had not been on a war party, he bore no title and was classified as a boy. Nor is the notion of war as the portal to manhood confined to primitives. After the U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989, the press hailed President Bush for succeeding in an initiation rite by demonstrating his willingness to shed blood. Male leadership, just like adult male status in general, must be proved with blood. Women could, potentially, have been warriors in far greater numbers than they have been. The female disadvantage in the realm of muscular strength was mitigated long ago with the invention of the bow and arrow, not to mention that great leveler of our own era, the gun. Nor, as Jean Bethke Elstein emphasizes in her study of women and war, do women have any innate inhibition against fighting and shedding blood. Revolutions and insurrections have again and again utilized women in combat roles, if only because revolutionary forces are generally less formal and tradition-bound than the armies of nation-states. One can also find plenty of examples of less high-minded collective violence on the part of women. In 1677, a mob of women in Marblehead, Massachusetts, stormed through the cortege guarding a pair of Indian prisoners, leaving the poor captives with their flesh in a manner pulled from their bones. More recently, on July 12, 1993, four members of the overseas press were pulled from their car and torn apart by a crowd of vengeful Somali women. Even as non-combatants, women have played lethal roles in men's wars. According to a 19th century ethnographer, Polynesian women had the job of selecting and cooking defeated enemies for post-battle feasts. They pick out the good bodies of the slain for the oven and throw the bad away. They tie up a captive to a tree, dig a hole, and kindle a hot stone oven for his body before his very eyes. The women go to battle. They keep to the rear and attend to the commissariat. Whenever they see one of the enemy fall, it is their business to rush forward, pull the body behind, and dress it for the oven. Among some Amerindian tribes, it was the business of women to torture enemy captives. And for what it's worth, Kipling warned his fellow Britishers in Afghanistan to shoot themselves rather than fall into the hands of the female enemy. If you're wounded and left out on Afghanistan's plains, and the women come out to cut up what remains, just roll to your rifle and blow out your brains and go to your death like a soldier. So there is no compelling biological or natural reason why men have so exclusively starred in the drama of war. Men make wars for many reasons, but one of the most recurring ones is to establish that they are, in fact, real men. Warfare and aggressive masculinity have been, in other words, mutually reinforcing cultural enterprises. War-making requires warriors, that is, real men. And the making of warriors requires war. Thus, war becomes a solution to what Margaret Mead termed the recurrent problem of civilization, which is to define the male role satisfactorily enough. This particular way of defining the male role inevitably had disastrous consequences for the female one as well. Their exclusion from warriordom did not mean that women were excluded from the terrors of war, safely consigned to the role of bystanders and baby makers. If war made men predators, it tended to make women into slaves, prizes of war, much like grain stores and cattle. As Gerda Lerner concludes from her study of gender in the ancient Middle East, there is overwhelming historical evidence for the preponderance of the practice of killing or mutilating male prisoners, and for the large-scale enslavement and rape of female prisoners. To survive as a captive, and help ensure the survival of her captive children, a woman had to be, at least superficially, submissive and compliant. In the Trojan Women, Euripides has Hecuba advise her daughter-in-law Andromache, widow of the Trojan hero Hector. You must forget what happened with Hector. Tears will never save you now. Give your obedience to the new master. Let your ways entice his heart to make him love you. If you do, it will be better for all who are close to you. But it is not only the captive women who would have been ground down by the practice of enslaving female prisoners of war. A woman within the victorious society might see her husband return from war with an attractive young captive or two. Just as Clytemnestra saw Agamemnon return from Troy with the Trojan princess Cassandra. And even without sexual competition between women of the victorious and defeated groups, the practice of treating women as booty may well have encouraged misogyny in the victors. In the situation Lerner describes, where enemy males were killed and enemy females enslaved, the only surviving adult representatives of the defeated enemy would, of course, be female. And the psychological equation would have been established, over time, between femaleness and the enemy other. Could the male role be defined in ways that are more peaceable and less damaging to both sexes? Yes, certainly. War is not the only way of establishing a division of labor, or even a hierarchy of power, between men and women. There have been societies or subgroups within societies where men grow up not to fight, but to take on a distinctive role as herders of animals, plowers of the soil, or salary-earning office workers. But even in these settings, the warrior usually still holds pride of place as a masculine ideal, the hero of epic tales and, in our own time, the star of Hollywood action movies. Arguably, the primordial male hunter-defender deserved whatever special status he was accorded within his culture. In battling wild animals, predators or fierce ungulates like the aurochs, he risked and often sacrificed his life to serve the human group. But the warrior who evolved from the hunter-defender was not so clearly deserving of the prestige he won at Spearpoint. He too might give his life for the group in campaigns portrayed as thoroughly justified and defensive. But insofar as war is something man-made, insofar as it can be considered an artifact of human culture, he was on potentially far shakier ground than the battler of wild beasts. Someone, some real-life Lysistrata, or analog of the much-maligned Clytemnestra, might notice the circular logic linking masculinity and war. That men make war, in part, because war makes them men. And conclude that men could stop. But could they? To say that the practice of war may have begun as something for men to do, a system for allocating prestige analogous to that of the male sub-band's hunt, does not mean that it can be seen forever after as men's fault. War is not just a product of human impulses, a crime repeated fresh in each generation. Once unleashed, it has a furious power of its own, which human cultures ignore at their own peril. The warrior's business may first have begun as a protection racket. But as soon as there was a real external threat to protect against, the incursions of foreign tribes or empires, the male warrior may indeed have earned his status as a local hero. 8. Fearful Symmetries. Is it not wonderful for a man, having been born a man, to die at the hands of another man, and then, with his quiver and bow at his side, lie on the ground as a corpse? Mongolian proverb from the time of Genghis Khan. However and wherever war begins, it persists, it spreads, it propagates itself through time and across space, with the terrifying tenacity of a beast attached to the neck of living prey. This is not an idly chosen figure of speech. War spreads and perpetuates itself through a dynamic that often seems independent of human will. It has, as we like to say of things we do not fully understand, a life of its own. Biological metaphors for war are popular among those who study war abstractly, through the grid of mathematics. Normally, we think of war as a product of human volition, an activity, a habit, perhaps an institution, growing out of human needs and cultural proclivities. And of course, it is that. Take away human whims and passions, and there is no war, or at least no human versions of it. But if we consider war abstractly, we see that something else is going on. As the Dutch social scientist Henk Houweling points out, the mathematical study of outbreaks of war and of national decisions to participate in wars shows strong indications of epidemicity. By using methods of epidemiology, we do not suggest, of course, that wars are transmitted by bacteria or by common exposure to some causal variable in the environment. Our analysis does not reveal the cause of war. But it does suggest that one of the causes of war is war itself. If war is analogous to a disease, then it is analogous to a contagious disease. It spreads through space as groups take up warfare in response to warlike neighbors. This may seem obvious, but statistical studies show that warfare is indeed more intense and frequent in the vicinity of warlike groups. War has another way of spreading too, and that is through time. Ineluctably, the insults inflicted in one war call forth new wars of retaliation, which may be waged within months of the original conflict or generations later. Even the conditions of peace may serve as a springboard to new wars, as the modern world learned from the Treaty of Versailles. Among the Central Nga of New Guinea, unpaid indemnities from one war are a common excuse for the next one. So, to continue the epidemiological metaphor, if war is regarded as an infectious disease, it is caused by a particularly hardy sort of microbe. one capable of insisting itself for generations, if necessary, within the human soul. Stated in more conventional terms, war spreads from band to band and culture to culture because it is a form of contact that no human group can afford to ignore or disdain. If outsiders show up hoping to woo mates or trade goods or induct you into their religious practices, you can always tell them to go away. But, as Andrew Barge Schmuckler argues in his brilliant exploration of human power relationships, The Parable of the Tribes, you can no more brush off a war party than you can tell a mugger who demands your money or your life that, frankly, you'd rather keep both and continue peaceably along your way. If the other tribe harbors a core of thuggish aggressors, so must yours, or fall prey to those who thought up thuggery first. No warlike instinct, greedy impulses, or material needs are required to explain why war, once adopted by some, must of necessity be adopted by all. Peaceable societies will survive only in isolated or marginal locales, the deep forests of the Umbato, the snowfields of the Inuit. Everyone else is swept up into the dynamic of war. As Schmuckler writes, among all the cultural possibilities, only some will be viable. The warlike may eliminate the pacifistic, the ambitious, the content. Civilized societies will displace the remaining primitives. Modern industrial powers will sweep away archaic cultures. The iron makers will be favored over those with copper, or no metallurgy at all. And the horsemen will have sway over the unmounted. Societies that are coherently organized and have strong leadership will make unviable others with more casual power structure and more local autonomy. What looked like open-ended cultural possibilities are channeled in a particular, unchosen direction. In other words, as it spreads from place to place, war tends to stamp a certain sameness on human cultures. At the most obvious level, it requires that each human society be as war-ready as the other societies it is likely to encounter, that spears be matched with spears, fighting men matched with the men of potential enemy groups, and that in all groups, similar proportions of energy and resources be dedicated to destructive ends. No doubt there are other directions in which human cultures might have evolved, toward greater emphasis on the arts, for example, or philosophy, or more lighthearted games and rituals. But war, once chosen by some, quickly became the unchosen direction imposed on all. Most scholars have paid little attention to the homogenizing effects of war. The enemy, after all, is always the fearsome and wicked other. The occasions for each particular war will vary, perhaps, Robin Fox has written. But ultimately, we fight them because they are different. And their difference is threatening in its challenge to the validity of the ideas we live by. Similarly, Ruth Benedict argued that the problem arises from what is basically a cognitive confusion. Our fellow humans often look to us like animals. Give the other tribe a strange accent, a peculiar religion, or unusual style of body paint, and in our provincialism, we take them for a different species. In primitive societies, she wrote, human beings are merely one's own little tribe. The rest are non-human, like the animals. Killing animals is, of course, acclaimed, and non-human bipeds of the neighboring tribe are equally objects of prey. Their death proves my strength, just as a successful lion hunt does. Left unexplained in this account is why Homo sapiens, being so famously intelligent in other respects, should alone of all the species be unable to recognize its own kind. In fact, there is reason to believe that diverse cultures have been capable of peaceful interaction for many thousands of years, meaning that they were also capable of recognizing one another as human. For example, the vast distribution of Venus figurines throughout the Eurasian continent would seem to attest to cultural contact and exchange among presumably quite different peoples as early as the Upper Paleolithic. By the Neolithic, goods like obsidian were being traded across thousands of miles in the Mediterranean and Near East. Again, presumably among people who recognized one another as human beings. Even the most parochially minded Paleolithic bands were probably exogamous. That is, disposed to pick mates from outside the band, rather than risk incest within. Diversity is endemic to the human race, which would have had to realize long ago that the stranger may be next year's trading partner or kin. Conversely, warfare is hardly confined to groups that differ strikingly in culture, language, and appearance. On the contrary, anthropologist Lawrence H. Keeley observes that ethnographers have frequently encountered tribes that intermarried and traded with one another, but were also periodically at war. Peaceful trading and socializing may alternate with vicious warfare, a pattern observed among certain Inuit, North American Indian, and Brazilian tribes. To quote Keeley, "When the Sioux came to trade at Hidatsa villages along the Upper Missouri, a truce was in force only within sight of the villages.